If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
Why then is it so important at this juncture in history, 162 years after our Synod was founded, to rethink the way the LCMS is structured and governed? Our history has been marked by numerous attempts through structure and governance revisions to enhance, clarify, or rectify the way we live and work together. Yet we still have a lack of clarity as to what the Synod really is, what it does, and how it should function.
That's President Gerald Kieschnick of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod talking about proposed changes to the structure and governance of that, one of the larger Lutheran church bodies in the U.S. It actually is the second largest by a long shot. But come here in about 2 weeks, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is going to be seriously considering some really radical changes to its constitution, to the way it governs itself, to its national bureaucracy, and all sorts of changes are afoot. How many will come, how many will go, we don't know. But it behooves us to continue to look at these proposed changes in structure and governance for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which we will do here in the first hour of Issues Etc. live this Tuesday, June the 22nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. Ken Sherb will be our guest. He's been with us on this subject several times before. This is the last time we're going to kind of wrap this up before the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod meets for its triennial convention in mid-July. In the second hour of the program, we're going to pick up where we left off yesterday. Our conversation late last week with Brian McLaren about the emergent church movement, we got about a third of the way into it, and we're going to conclude that conversation. We want you to listen, and then we want your response to Brian McLaren and everything he has to say on the emergent church movement. I'll give you a little heads up here. Yesterday was kind of foundation laying in that conversation with Brian McLaren. Today's part of the conversation is far more revealing about what he affirms and what he denies in matters of the historic Christian faith. You will want to listen, and I urge you to respond. Our call-in number for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. You can email us here in the studio, talkback at issuesetc.org, Twitter us at issuesetc, or leave your questions and comments on President Gerald Kieschnick's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Synod Structure and Governance at our Issues Etc. Facebook fan page. It's facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri. Formerly served as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and as a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's a regular guest. Ken, welcome back.
Hey there, Todd. Hi from Moberly. It's the first full day of summer, and boy, the heat is on.
It is here, too, and we soldier on in spite of it. Okay, the average person sitting in the pew, Ken, is going to say, I can't think of anything that may interest me less than the restructuring largely of the bureaucracy and the governance of a national church body. Please explain to us at the outset here how the proposed changes of President Kieschnick's Blue Ribbon Task Force for Structure and Governance of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has the potential to impact the average person sitting in the pew.
It's about as, I don't know, maybe an ostrich kind of head in the sand posture to take when you say, well, this is of no particular interest to the person sitting in the pew, as it would be to say national health care and that whole debate has nothing to do with the average citizen of the United States. Yeah, it's true. You can make some changes to governmental structures in every sort of government, including those of church bodies, that amount to relatively little impact on anybody but the people directly involved in implementing them. The proposals of this task force have been, from the very start, much more far-reaching, even in concept. President Kishnick charged this group with doing what they called a zero-based assessment of the entire synodical structure. It's possible, in theory, that they could have come up with even more changes than what they have. As it is, the convention next month is going to have some 34 different resolutions to deal with, brought by the floor committee dealing with all this task force material. And so it's quite broad-ranging, changing everything from the confessional paragraph in the Synod's Constitution to the way that the church body is organized, the way it divides labor between various agencies at the national level, between the national and the district level. This all does filter down to congregations. One of the things I've learned about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod over the years is it's not an antinomian group. This group does pretty much abide by, broadly speaking, the things that are said in conventions. And so I learned this working for the Synod, actually. I'd say, why in the world do we have this and this going on? And I'd look back and find that maybe it was two or three conventions back, but some convention had authorized it. So what gets decided at these conventions does finally impact on people in the pew, sure.
Maybe a good place to begin is there was throughout this last year, I think it's safe to say, a series of meetings with the districts of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Yeah.
Where the representatives of President Kishnick's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Structure and Governance tried to explain their proposals, wanted feedback from their proposals, and took surveys. Let's talk about the use and the evaluation of the survey results, especially in the final report and the way that the proposals are being brought before the church body at the convention.
Some of the overtures that are being brought by the floor committee to the convention even cite those statistics. They'll say, in the survey of convention delegates that took place at the 2009 round of district conventions, and that ultimately involves, at least ideally, delegates from every congregation in the Synod. So it's not a bad sample to survey. They'll say, you know, like 74% either strongly agreed or at least agreed with this, and so therefore we bring this proposal now before the convention. The flaw potentially in just a facile taking of that number at face value is this. The task force, when it brought its proposals to the district conventions and took these surveys, could not possibly be expected to survey the delegates on every single word of every single change in every constitutional provision, every bylaw, or anything else. They obviously had to clump things together. So they had 20 different recommendations that they were discussing with the delegates at the district conventions. Obviously, if you take a broad-ranging set of structure changes like this and group them into 20 different groupings or recommendations, you've got to cluster several subpoints under each recommendation. Now, Todd, suppose you were a delegate, and I was the delegate sitting in the seat next to you, and suppose we're very like-minded, we agree really about everything. You might look at one of the recommendations that the task force made, and you might say, well, on average, I think that, you know, my average response to these six or seven subpoints that are underneath this one recommendation is that I agree with them. I don't strongly agree, but I agree. So you'd put down that numerical ranking of a four. I, sitting right next to you, and again, agreeing with you about everything in principle, might see among those one item that I disagree with. Maybe I don't strongly disagree with it, but I do disagree with it, and because I'm so locked on that one that I disagree with, instead of averaging out all the items in that set the way you did, I put it down as a two, a disagree, because there's that one particular item that sticks out like a sore thumb to me. Now, you may have looked at that same item and said, well, I don't like that one, but there's a bunch of these other things that I do like. See, we could agree in principle about the same things, but we could have responded very differently to the survey question. So you have to be a little bit wary about the use of these survey statistics.
All right. Then I guess what I'm wondering is it better to simply leave aside how these things polled, so to speak, among the delegates? When you're making an appeal to the delegates, is it relevant, really, whether or not the delegates who looked at it the first time liked what they saw or didn't like what they saw? Isn't the real question whether or not these are wise, prudent, and above all, kind in step with our theological way of looking at the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod?
Of course. The delegates to this convention are the ones who really have to make the decision about these resolutions. Furthermore, the delegates to this convention have the advantage that delegates at district conventions did not have of just having this stuff in front of them for a longer period of time.
Okay, so where, just so we can clarify here, where does this, how is this all going to be decided so that those who are not in the know know how these things are going to be decided, how things will be passed or either or voted down?
Well, the task force, like every other agency or entity of the Synod, submits its report to the convention, and it came out in the convention workbook. Actually, the task force report was so massive that it was published in a separate volume. But it is a report to the Synod from the task force, just like you'd have a report from the mission board or whatever. Floor committees are chosen by the president of the Synod to prepare the business for the convention's consideration. So these floor committees, and I think there are 8 resolution-bringing floor committees to this convention. That's not an atypical number. There is one floor committee, in fact, it is committee number 8, that has been charged with processing the recommendations of the task force and any overtures from congregations or agencies of the Synod that bear on the work of the task force. This floor committee, which is composed of voting or advisory delegates to the 2010 convention.
About 30 seconds here.
These people have the responsibility to come up with now resolutions, and they have. As I think I noted a moment ago, they have 34 resolutions that respond to the work of the task force. That's one-third of the total number of resolutions that this convention will consider.
All right, when we come back, more on Restructuring the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod with Dr. Ken Sherb. Stay tuned. What can a view from space teach us about God's care for His creation, His wisdom in ordering the universe, and the goodness of divine providence? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June is titled The Work of His Hands. It's written by astronaut Jeffrey Williams. Colonel Williams spent 6 months aboard the International Space Station. You can purchase The Work of His Hands by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. The Work of His Hands.
The CLCC has produced a new seminar to help people understand the structure of LCMS churches. So many people today are unaware of their church polity. This seminar can be downloaded for free from the CLCC website, www.theclcc.org. This is available for a seminar, a self-study, or presentations. And think about joining us. Members can download the PowerPoint version for free. Visit us today at www.theclcc.org.
Lutheran Radio in Exile. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. Mount Zion Lutheran, Greenfield, Wisconsin. Pilgrim Lutheran, West Bend, Wisconsin. Messiah Lutheran, Lebanon, Illinois. Zion Lutheran, Accident, Maryland. Redeemer Lutheran, Jackson, Wyoming. Messiah Lutheran, Marysville, Washington. Trinity Lutheran, Millstadt, Illinois. Our Savior Lutheran, Houston, Texas. St. Matthew's Lutheran, Bon Terre, Missouri. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Lincoln, Nebraska. Hope Lutheran, St. Louis, Missouri. Trinity Lutheran, Austin, Texas. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Collinsville, Illinois. Luther Memorial Chapel, Shorewood, Wisconsin. Christ Lutheran, Oak Park, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran, Naperville, Illinois. And Emmanuel Lutheran, Dearborn, Michigan. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget at our website, issuesetc.org. Click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Tuesday afternoon, June the 22nd. Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. We're talking about President Gerald Kishnick's Blue Ribbon Task Force on the restructuring of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Ken, as we were going to the break, you were talking about the specific resolution, 34 to be exact, about a large number of the total that the delegates will consider in 10 days of meeting there at the convention. And yet, the task force, when it made its final report, provided no enabling resolutions. What's an enabling resolution? Why is it significant that that's been left to the floor committees largely?
Well, let me talk about these 34 resolutions by way of broad stroke, then I'll come back to your point. Some of these resolutions, most of them in fact, entail some kind of a change to the Synod's governing documents, that is to say, the Constitution or the bylaws. As I say, most of them do entail that. Now, if you're a delegate, you know that you got your first issue of today's business, and more than half the pages in that today's business are the actual demonstration of how the bylaws would look, and the Constitution, for that matter, if the proposals of the floor committee are adopted. So each resolution that calls for changing various provisions of the Constitution and bylaws, you have to look to the back of the book to see those changes. They're all there for you. They're all demonstrated, but you do have to kind of be a little bit apt about how you go back and forth from one page to the other. So most of the resolutions do call for some sort of a change in the Constitution or bylaws. Some of them call for a great deal of change. Some of them call for relatively little change. It really depends upon the subject matter that's at hand. The resolution that calls for the most change by volume is Resolution 808, which would really restructure the Synod's national operations. It would eliminate all the existing program boards, go down to two national and international mission boards. It's the most far-ranging and word-intensive proposal that the floor committee is bringing forth. But again, that's just by simple quantity of words. It's not necessarily qualitatively the most important, but it's the one that's the biggest. Now, there are a few of these proposed resolutions from the floor committee, four by my count, that do not themselves change the governing documents or any provisions in the governing documents, but they do enable various resolutions of the task force to be implemented. I've always found it remarkable that the task force did not propose these enabling resolutions. What the task force gave us was proposed Constitution and bylaw rewording. But you never go from point A to point B on a dime. Phased implementation is quite common when changes are made in any governance structure, whether that be your state legislature writing new laws, or whether it be the Department of Motor Vehicles coming up with new regulations for driving in a given place. Usually those who make a proposal are the ones who are in the best position to recommend how to go about implementing it and how to go about phasing it in. But in this case, the Blue Ribbon Task Force simply told the Synod, in effect, that we think these are all good, we recommend them all, we think you should adopt as much of this as quickly as possible, and you figure out how to go about doing that. You figure out how to phase it in. So it kind of left this big baby on the doorstep of the floor committee. I might add that there's one overture that was submitted by no less than three districts, three circuit forums in three different states, and several different congregations, again, in different districts, urging that the task force submit the complete text, not only of its proposed Constitution and bylaw changes, but also of any of its recommended enabling resolutions, in time for people to have seen that with the convention workbook that was published basically at the beginning of May. And again, the task force just resolved not to do that. In fact, my congregation was one of those that submitted such a request to the task force. And the task force chairman wrote us back a very nice little note and email, and he said, we're not going to submit any resolutions to the convention. So the floor committee has had to come up with this. That leads to another point, and that is ordinarily the numbering of resolutions and the order in which they appear in your convention materials is at least a little bit indicative of the kind of relative importance that the floor committee attaches to the various proposals. And if you look just at the surface, again, the way these things are organized, which ones come first, which ones come second, you'll see that most of the Constitution changes that are being proposed are prioritized pretty low. I dare say, though, in fact, I'm quite confident in my prediction that these resolutions will not come to the convention, will not be brought by the floor committee to the convention in the order in which you find them here. For the simple reason that that massive resolution 808 that I talked about a moment ago, which would call for the creation of two new boards that don't even exist right now, there's another resolution that calls for election of members to the board of directors, at least some of the members of the synodical board of directors, to be done on a regional basis. And there's another that's an enabling resolution that would enable those elections to take place at this convention. Those are all things that, the floor committee is going to have to bring to the attention of the convention first, if only because the floor committee obviously wants to try to implement all this stuff immediately. They're bringing this enabling resolution that would enable the Synod to hold these elections right away. So you're not going to find these things coming up necessarily in the order that they're given to you in today's business.
Kind of a discursus for a moment, just a question of mine. When I was looking through the workbook, I noticed that there were a lot, 70 plus, memorials submitted by districts, circuits, congregations all across the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, expressing concern, asking that more time be taken, asking for more time to look at it, sometimes asking to completely dispense with the entire thing. And none of them are reflected in what Floor Committee 8 finally turned out. Is that unusual?
Well, you know, the floor committee is in between a rock and a hard place when it has different overtures from different congregations or agencies of the synod that come down on different sides of the same question. Now, what this floor committee chose to do when it got some people saying, yeah, let's go ahead and take these task force proposals up right now, and it looked at other things that said, no, let's not, let's delay, let's, for example, the Missouri district memorialized this convention to receive the report of the task force in 2010, but not to act on it until 2013, the next convention. The floor committee is always between a rock and a hard place when it has contradictory things to look at. It can't say both. This one decided that it was going to go ahead, and in fact, in most respects, this floor committee decided to go ahead with what the task force had recommended. There's very little change, some, but very little change that the floor committee made to what the task force recommended.
All right, let's talk a little bit about one of those enabling resolutions, 815, talking about these regional elections you mentioned just a second ago.
Yeah, this point, I think, Todd, is huge, and I say this from the perspective of one who serves on the Synodical Nominating Committee. Talk about people who are between a rock and a hard place. If the convention decides to create two new boards and to change the way you elect members of the synodical board of directors, to elect some of them on a regional basis, then we're technically unprepared for that right now. See, no call for nominations has gone out to the synod so that people in the field can submit the names of likely prospective good candidates to serve on these two new mission boards. Likewise, when the call for nominations for Board of Directors candidates went out, nobody said, we have to do this on a regional basis. The nominations committee, therefore, has done a little bit of thinking. We knew that this was a prospect that was out there, that this kind of change might be made. We've got some preliminary work done on it, but we don't have those slates finished. We don't have them really any more than started. And from the standpoint of the typical delegate, and this, I think, is a big consideration, the typical delegate won't get to see those slates until the convention is already underway. Because until the convention is already underway and authorizes the creation of these regions in the first place, nobody has any business talking formally, officially, about regents. Now, we may be informally talking about it in the nominating committee and elsewhere just to try to be prepared, but the point is you will only get a regionally based slate of nominees for any office only after the convention is underway. And if I were a delegate, I would frankly just want more time.
We've got about a minute here before we take a break. It sounds like trying to change the transmission on your car while you're on your family vacation driving down the highway.
Well, there is an overture in the convention workbook. It's Overture 811 on pages 224 and 225 that has, hopefully, a better way. It simply says that the Senate, even if it adopts, for example, Resolution 808 and creates these new mission boards, we won't implement them at this convention. In other words, we'll live with the existing program boards for another 3 or 4, whatever it happens to be, years. We will live with the board of directors on a non-regional basis for another period of time. And that will enable us to do the entire nominations process from the beginning and get it done in a decent and orderly fashion heading into the next convention.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. We're talking about President Gerald Kishnick's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Synod Structure and Governance. It's Tuesday afternoon, June the 22nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. coming to you live. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. You can email us here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, Twitter us at @IssuesETC, or leave your questions or comments on restructuring the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/IssuesETC.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/IssuesETC, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at @IssuesETC. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/IssuesETC, and on Twitter at @IssuesETC. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/IssuesETC, and on Twitter at @IssuesETC.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
When we say Lutheran, we mean Lutheran. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Summer just started, so are you thinking about Christmas? A group of churches in England are. They're putting posters on bus shelters throughout the country showing a picture of a baby via ultrasound. The baby has a halo, and the text reads, "He's on his way. Christmas starts with Christ." It sends a pro-life message and the true meaning of Christmas when people aren't being inundated with so-called holiday overload. In part, it's a response to a highly controversial TV advertising campaign of abortion mills. Marie Stopes has gone to the airwaves to promote their killing business. These churches hope that clever posters will bring a focus to the central victim of abortion, innocent unborn babies. Visit today's broadcast link at lifeissues.org if you'd like to see the poster.
Life Issues. Stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about restructuring the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, which may well happen here in about 2 weeks. as that Lutheran church body meets in convention, Houston, Texas. First thing on the agenda, Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. Ken, this is we come to my concern all along, and I've expressed it with you, I think, every time we've talked about this, and that is that the delegates may inadvertently commit themselves to one thing and by adopting resolutions that have kind of incidental language in them, as you call it. That is, if they adopt one thing, they kind of commit themselves to adopt another thing, and pretty soon it's snowballing down the hill. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, this is an important thing to watch, and again, the changes that are being proposed by this task force are so many and varied, I don't blame the floor committee for having its hands full trying to keep track of all of these and trying to come up with sensible ways to package these for the convention's consideration. But I'll just give you one example. The proposed resolution 805 has the title to elect delegates to the Synod Convention. And that is primarily what it's about, the process for electing delegates to the Synod Convention. But one of the bylaws that it changes also talks about what the term of these delegates is going to be. So if you adopt Resolution 805, you are adopting a 4-year term of service for the delegates to the convention. That's 805. But it's not until you get to Resolutions 818 and 819 that the floor committee proposes changing to an actual 4-year convention cycle so that you've got your conventions occurring every 4 years.
Okay, let me stop you there. Does this mean that potentially the delegates could vote on 808 and say, we're just talking about how we elect these delegates, oh, by the way, every 4 years, and then find themselves essentially painted into a corner having to adopt 818 and 819 because they already adopted whatever the previous one was.
Yeah, 805.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you're not absolutely painted into a corner, at least you could have the debate turn now, not on the merits of the question, whether it's a good thing to have a 4-year as opposed to a 3-year convention cycle or a 4-year or 3-year term for delegates, but the debate could turn on, well, we already adopted the 4-year term for the delegates. How can we not adopt the 4-year convention cycle? So if I were a delegate, I would want to just have my eyes absolutely peeled on anything like that. And I, you know, might offer an amendment to Resolution 805, for example, saying we will only go with this 4-year term that this set of constitutional or actually bylaw changes entails if later on the convention adopts the constitutional amendment going to a 4-year convention cycle. And in this case, also if the congregations of the synod ratify that. Because, see, any constitutional change has not only got to be adopted by a 2-thirds vote of the convention, it's got to be ratified by 2-thirds of the congregations that respond to a letter from the secretary of the synod containing that amendment after the convention. So you'd have real egg on your face if you adopted a 4-year term for delegates. And then, yeah, maybe the convention goes ahead and passes the 4-year convention cycle, but the congregations don't ratify that.
All right. My head's swimming. I can only imagine what's going to like to be a convention delegate during those first couple of days.
It just involves doing your homework. You got to read every line, and you got to read, in this case, not only the resolutions themselves, you've got to read any resolution that purports to change bylaws or constitution. You've got to read those proposed changes in the bylaws or constitution.
Now, this is important. Do the delegates have more options than simply to vote something up or down?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, obviously, those are the most obvious ones. Sooner or later, if nothing else happens, there's going to be a yay or nay vote. Do you adopt the resolution or do you not? And the ayes are either going to have it or the nays. But short of that, there are other possibilities. These proposals can be referred for further study, short-term or long-term. If the convention thinks, for example, that the floor committee needs to have another run at this and needs to go back and do another, you know, night's work trying to hammer out better wording, you can refer it back to the floor committee for a short-term referral. For a long-term referral, if somebody's convinced that some proposal really needs further study, remember, the Synod has a standing Commission on Structure. It would be slightly changed under the new proposals, and it would be called Commission on Handbook. But their ongoing task is to look to the structure of the Synod and to offer calm, dispassionate advice about what changes can be made and what are the pros and cons of making those changes. So, yeah, you can refer these things short-term or long-term. Another possibility is, on a given question, just to postpone it. Say, you know, we really need this whole convention cycle to think about this particular thing. So postpone it to the next convention. So, yeah, you do have other options if you're a delegate. You don't only have to vote yes or no.
All right. Before we go on to, you have said that the floor committee largely simply passed through much of what the Blue Ribbon Task Force had recommended. There are some wrinkles in there. I want to get to those. But before we get to that, just a kind of a point of order. There are two.
You're already in convention mode, Todd.
No, I'm never in convention mode. I've never been one to one officially, and hope never to be to one officially. The schedule as it reads today is to spend 2 days hammering out the proposals from the floor committee about structure and governance, and then what usually comes at the very beginning of an ordinary convention will happen on day three, and that is the election of the president of synod. What is the reasoning here, and is it significant?
I'm not sure I'm the best person to ask about this because, you know, this really wasn't my idea. The factor you've got to bear in mind, well, there's a couple of factors you've got to bear in mind, and they're related. This convention is longer than your typical Missouri Synod convention. Actually, the size of our conventions has been shrinking over the years. Say 30 years ago, the Synod would probably have met on about this kind of schedule. You would actually have your opening service on a Saturday night, and you would adjourn, the following Friday, typically. This convention is actually going to run through to the following Saturday for adjournment. And the reason why this convention is so long is because the convention planners were taking account of the work of this task force, and they knew that there was going to be an awful lot of, you know, time that needed to be devoted. I wonder whether a whole week can't be devoted just to talking about these far-reaching changes of the task force. I wonder if a couple of days will even do it. But anyway, the convention is longer, and because the convention is longer, there is a little bit more elbow room. See, by bylaw, the first election that has to take place at a synodical convention in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is the election of the president. The next election is the election of the first vice president. The next election is for the other vice presidents in line of succession to the presidency, and currently that's four others. And then you have a bunch of other elections, and from that point on, it doesn't make so much difference, the order of elections. But those first few are you know, lined out in the bylaws, and you've got to do them in that order. And so,
have to do them all together?
I'm sorry?
Do you have to do them all together?
Well, no, you don't do them all together. You elect the president, and only after you elect the president do you elect the first vice president.
Well, my question is, why not elect president first order of business, since it's largely unaffected by the proposed changes in structure? And then those offices that will be affected by proposed changes, their elections can wait until after restructuring is considered.
Yeah, in principle, I don't think there's any reason why the election of the president and the first vice president, and even for that matter, the other vice presidents, because nobody has regional nominations in hand for those. And it's not even the nominating committee's responsibility to bring regional nominations under the task force proposals. Those have to be brought by the regions themselves. So, I mean, it's absolutely certain in my mind that there will be no regional election of vice presidents at this convention, even if that is adopted. We're just not ready for it. There's not the wherewithal to do it. But I think in principle, yeah, you could elect those offices early on in the convention. The reason why it typically happens, well, the formal reason why it happens early in the convention that you elect the president and the vice presidents, is to get those elections done so that you can proceed on to the other elections. Because sometimes those get to be very complicated. It'll take multiple ballots sometimes. You have runoffs, and you need the time. Now, again, in a convention that has, you know, 5 days of business sessions, it's more important to get an early start than in this convention that has, I guess, 8 days of business sessions. The informal reason, and it's kind of been a kind of, I don't know, a point of pride almost in the Missouri Synod, we get that presidential election done first thing on the first morning, typically, of convention business, before the delegates take their lunch break, so that we can then turn to the other business. The presidential election is always a big consideration at any convention. It's one of the most important decisions that's always made at a convention, whether it's an incumbent who's running or whether there's no incumbent running. It's one of the most important things the convention does, and so you do it when you're fresh, and you do it right out of the box. In this case, the plan, according to this tentative agenda, which, of course, is subject to change, it hasn't been adopted yet, it's simply a tentative agenda that's been proposed, is to have the presidential election on Tuesday after you begin business on Sunday.
All right, we'll pick that up on the other side of the break. Dr. Ken Cherb is our guest. Stay tuned.
Deaconess Pam Nielsen of Concordia Publishing House on the uniqueness of the Sunday school curriculum, Growing in Christ.
That in every lesson, at every level in Growing in Christ, we point out salvation in Christ Jesus, forgiveness of sins, life forever in Christ, so that stories aren't taught as great miracles or moral stories or moments in time, hero stories. They're taught always with Christ in full view, Christ as our Savior from sin, death, and the devil. And that makes all the difference, because that's what matters for eternity, not how wowed the children are this week with the coolness of the story and the miracle that's presented. It's all about Christ, and that's why we call it Growing in Christ.
You can receive free samples of Growing in Christ for your Sunday school by calling Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040 or check out Growing in Christ at cph.org.
We still have a pastor on staff. You're listening to Issues Etc.
June 30th marks the two-year anniversary of the return of Issues Etc. And if you've enjoyed listening to Issues Etc., please consider making a special anniversary contribution. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make a special anniversary gift by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
Hi, this is Ville calling from Finland. I believe the day will come when you cannot enter the office as a pastor in the ELCA unless you subscribe to the ordination of gays and lesbians. And why do I believe that? Because Americans are sinners like we Finns are.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about President Gerald Kieschnick's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Synod Structure and Governance. Dr. Ken Cherb is our guest, pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri, formerly served as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, and as a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ken, let's pick up where you left off. We were talking about the timing of the presidential elections vis-a-vis the restructuring proposals.
Well, I don't know. There's a whole lot more to say about it. Obviously, the convention will have to decide whether it wants this proposed agenda or whether it would like to modify it. And modifications are made usually at the beginning of a convention in one respect or another to the proposed agenda. It's not an unusual thing. It doesn't happen every time. But, you know, from my point of view, I don't know why we just don't elect the president right off. If I had been doing the proposed agenda, that's probably what I would have wanted to do.
Okay, you said before that the floor committee responsible for what the delegates will see simply passed through a lot of what the Blue Ribbon Task Force had recommended, but not everything.
The bulk of it, yeah.
You said there are wrinkles that we ought to take note of. What is it?
There are some new wrinkles here, some changes that the floor committee has made in the task force's proposal. The one that's probably the most noticeable and the one that's been most talked about and is likely to be talked about the most for the next couple of weeks is that unlike the task force, which had said that it wanted to have two offices, one of national mission and one of international mission, and each one of those would be linked to a commission, the floor committee is saying, no, we want these to be mission boards. We want them to be boards, not commissions. However, the task force brings a whole new definition of a mission board. And there is a section of the synodical bylaws that consists of nothing but definitions. And they propose a definition for a mission board. They, of course, eliminate the old category of program boards, and that definition is gone, too. It's no longer needed in their proposal. The two mission boards will reign but not rule. I guess that's my short summary of it. They are there to establish boundaries and parameters and principles for the National Mission Office in the one case and the International Mission Office in the other case. And it says they are to exercise oversight, but they will have no authority directly to control events. Like the International Mission Board will not directly be controlling things that happen in the Synod's International Mission Program. It is the president of the Synod who is held responsible in this proposed set of bylaws, Resolution 808, for supervising the implementation of the policies of these two mission boards. So the president of the Synod will be the primary actor here. These mission boards will not be boards of the sort we have now. They will not direct the affairs of their particular aspect of the Synod's work, the way, for example, the mission board does now.
Well, very briefly on this point, and then I want to get to some email. The president of Synod, if the proposals pass, will be supervising an awful lot of things that he doesn't presently supervise.
Oh, yeah. We've talked about this before, but, you know, this is one of the changes that the floor committee made. It proposed a sentence in the bylaws that is more clear and more direct and pointed than even anything I think the task force had. The sentence I'm talking about is where the proposed bylaws would say, and it says this about the president of the Synod, as ecclesiastical supervisor, he shall provide leadership to all officers, agencies, and national office staff of the Synod. That is a very sweeping statement, and it would make the president of the Synod, in effect, the leader of the entire organization.
Would that imply that all staff, all whatever it may be, would answer to him in some form or another?
Well, the Constitution already does indicate that the president has supervision with regard to the doctrine and administration of all who are employed by the Synod. I think what the task force and now the floor committee's work would do is to eliminate any other layers of responsibility that these workers for the Synod have to anybody else.
This is Frank in Cary, Illinois, via Facebook. He says, why do these changes have to be ramrodded through? One has to wonder, why so fast? Why so many changes? What is the motivation to change and change fast before the body as a whole wakes up to evaluate? Could the concept of a task force be flawed? Let's deal with this question. Why so fast? Why so many? Why ramrodded through?
Well, I don't have a good answer to that, Todd, because that's exactly the kind of question that I've been asking now for quite a while. I do make this observation. The case is made that we could save money because of some of these proposals. I don't know, frankly, whether restructuring from the current set of program boards to the two proposed mission boards, one for international, one for national mission, will in the long run save an appreciable amount of money. You won't be hauling as many board members around to meetings because there won't be as many boards to meet. Whether it will have an appreciable effect on the size of staff in and of itself, I don't know. Everything would depend upon the decisions that are actually made then by those mission offices under, again, policies established by the two mission boards as to whether they need fewer workers or more workers or something like that. Now, there's one place where there's an undeniable cost savings that could occur, and that is the task force's proposal to have synodical conventions on a less frequent basis. to have them every 4 years instead of every 3 years. Obviously, you won't have to pay for a convention as often. That money, by the way, does not come out of the cash flow of the national office. It's assessed to the congregations of the synod. But if you're talking about the synod as all the congregations, yeah, the congregations would save money if they're having conventions less frequently. Another place where you could save money is if you reduce the number of delegates to the national convention, as this task force wants to do. And then, by the way, that's another change. They say that the number of delegates at the national convention should be equal to about 10% of the number of congregations in the synod. So there's 6,100-some congregations in the synod. That means you'd have about 610 delegates at a national convention, which would be about half of what it is now. And obviously, fewer mouths to feed, fewer people to house. That's going to make for a cheaper convention, too. The thing that alarms me, though, is that there's more than one kind of cost. There are monetary costs, of course, and that's what a lot of the attention gets focused on, especially when money is tight. But there are things that money can't buy. I think that having broad-based participation by congregations and members of congregations in synodical boards, having a number of program boards upon which people can serve, has been a great thing to generate interest in the Synod and its work, to educate people in how the Synod works. One of the reasons I know as much about the Synod as I do today, however much that is because I served on a board when I was 18 years old. I was on the old youth board, and I learned from the inside some things about how this organization works. Other people who have served on boards have exactly the same experience, same way with convention delegates. You show me somebody who's been a delegate to a synodical convention or a district convention, and I'll show you somebody who comes away with a renewed interest and appreciation and just a level of involvement that they didn't have before. So the question is this a smart time to be reducing the number of people who can serve on boards, because we're cutting back radically on the number of boards we have? Is this the time to be reducing the size of the conventions and to have the conventions meet less frequently? Yeah, you can make the argument in monetary terms and in short-term kinds of considerations and say it will save us some money right now, but what will it cost us in the long run?
Finally, then, with only about 30 seconds, as we head into the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's convention next month, give us your final thoughts, Ken, on President Gerald Kieschnick's Blue Ribbon Task Force on structure and governance.
Well, I guess I can say, and I have the privilege to say this because I'm not a delegate and I don't have to have the responsibility of voting on these things. There are very few proposals of the task force that I would want to vote positively for. I'll tell you one that I would vote positively for, without a doubt, without a question. Make the chief financial officer of the synod an appointed position, appointed by the board of directors. That's an idea this task force has. It's actually an idea that they got from a previous task force. It's long overdue. But I can't get excited about a whole lot of the rest of what this task force is proposing.
Dr. Ken Sherb is pastor of Zion Lutheran Church in Moberly, Missouri, formerly served as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and is a theology professor at Concordia University in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ken, thank you very much, not only for this hour, but for all the previous hours you've spent doing the research and helping us understand these proposals over the last year or so.
I thank you for all the work that you have done trying to keep track of this. It's been, I think, enormous help to a lot of people. And by the way, those questions on the Issues Etc. website about the final report of the task force, very few of them have been answered to date by the floor committee. They still stand.
All right. We have a link there. We're going to have a direct link to those questions. And Dr. Ken Sherb, a great guest. Thank you very much. When we come back from this break, it's Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. Little participation near the end of this second hour for you. We're going to listen to the remainder of our conversation on the emergent church movement with Brian McLaren. I want you to listen carefully, because what you heard yesterday was just the beginning. In the second part of our conversation with him that we'll hear all through the second hour and get your reaction at the end, he actually is, you know, we were talking about trying to nail Jell-O to a wall. We're actually able to nail some of the Jell-O to the wall, and we're actually able to get him to affirm and deny certain things. And I think if you listen, you'll be very surprised what he affirms and especially what he denies. I'm Todd Wilken. Hour two of Issues Etc. is next. Brian McLaren, and then your reaction in the last 10 minutes. Stay tuned.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.